Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food and beverage radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll load. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that sin. It's gonna get you some in the end.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm Damon Bolte.
I'm Souther Teague.
And I'm Greg Benson. Gentlemen, it is winter, and that means it's award season out there. And
holy cow.
I know. And yeah. I know that I'm like the movies and TV guy here, but I actually don't watch this particular show. I'm starting to think maybe I should because it's cleaning up at the awards season. And not only that, but I'm also seeing the lead actor like in his underwear all over New York City these days. It seems like it's a big deal, but I've seen one episode and I loved it. I need to dive in. But do you guys watch The Bear?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen all the episodes that are available, which is two seasons worth, I think. I have opinions, Damon. I think you do as well.
Well, okay. So when it first came out, I was like, it hit too real for me working in the service industry, which I thought was a good thing. I mean, it was like, it's kind of hard to, you know, this show is, you know, a lot of it is about working in the service industry. And, you know, like to watch that show, especially in the beginning, it was like, oh God, like, it was like, this is a little too real. And, you know, it's hard to explain to people who haven't worked in the industry exactly like how crazy it can be. And I think it hit pretty hard on that. And so I was really, but the main part was for, you know, just for the actual just legitimacy of the show is that, you know, there are bottles of Fernet everywhere in the office and, you know, they're smoking all the time. But then also there's a giant Malort. You know, the show takes place in Chicago and there's a giant Malort billboard above the restaurant. And I was like, okay, they did the research. You know,
yeah, there are definitely some hidden gems in there. You know, the team drinking out of quart containers that sends a, you know, resonance for me. Do you think that the show is giving the general public a greater sense of empathy towards our field of endeavor?
I think so. I think, you know, yeah. But to be completely honest, like now that I live out here in, you know, the North Bay, San Francisco, I don't have as many industry friends that I hang out with on the regular as I did and still do in New York. So a lot of them are like civilians, you know, if you will. So the way they talk about it is very, I think that they're getting getting the message a lot, but also, I mean, like, I'm sure you have an opinion. I just want to say this real quick, though. Like, I love that Matty Matheson, like, he's been a friend of ours mm-hmm. for a long time. You know, he's really tight with the Franks, you know, Frankies and, you know, Prime Meats and all that stuff. So, like, I've just been around him for years. And then to see him play, to a large extent, himself on the show, you know, it's like, it's really cool. And I'm just happy for his success. But what's your take on it?
I mean, I think that having lived in Chicago for as long as I did and having been in kitchens for as long as I was, I can see a lot of things that they're definitely getting right about both Chicago and kitchens. But of course, it's for television. I see a lot of things that are wrong. So, but that's as an insider's view. I also do feel a lot of like agita and, you know, the way that they film it and the way that it's written. And it's really driving home the sort of stress level that we're kind of used to because we've been in it for so long. So I can certainly see that this would draw some greater sense of empathy from the general civilians, as you put them, about what it is we do in bars and restaurants. And I'm all for that. And I didn't know until Greg just mentioned before we got on the air that they're crushing all the awards. So I'll pay even closer attention, I guess, in the next season. But I like it. I certainly watch it, but I do see things that I'm like, you know, there's no way.
There's a cultural, social kind of situation in that show, like, that definitely goes back to what we faced in the cocktail bar world, right? Mm-hmm. With running cocktail programs.
A little bit of foot stamping to say that we're serious here. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And there's a lot of pushback, you know, and finally people started saying, like, they started realizing, like, oh, you're just trying to make good stuff, you know, and trying to like make it for us, you know, like, okay, I get it now. Right. Okay. And you know, it's worth a couple extra bucks for a drink or a sandwich or whatever the hell it might be. You know, it's like, it's like Brad Thomas Parsons. He lives up on Atlantic Avenue above Montero Bar, but you know, he goes down to DeFonte's. It's not far, but there's not like a Subway to get there, right. Or, you know, it's like, and it's the DeFonte's sandwich shop is legendary. And it's like, of course, you know, and he posts about it all the time. It's like, yeah, it's worth the extra effort to get there and have a better thing, you know?
Exactly.
So that's kind of my take on it. Greg, do you have any input on the show and all that?
Well, I only watched one episode, and it's the Feast of the Seven Fishes episode, which I thought was incredible.
Was that the Thanksgiving episode?
Maybe it was the Thanksgiving episode. Yeah, it was the one that has like Bob Odenkirk and John Mulaney and John Bernthal and Jamie Lee Curtis. That one.
Tough episode to watch, to be honest.
But so well done. I mean, my God, like that was the one I watched that at a friend's house, and I was just kind of like, okay, what's this show about? I need to take it seriously because I'd been not watching it in an almost deliberate way because I had sort of felt a little like we're sort of talking about like the way this show hits with the civilians. And I, in a sort of what I'll admit is a very contrarian, trolly sort of way, when people would find out what I did, they'd be like, they'd want to talk about The Bear. They'd be like, oh my God, do you watch The Bear? And I just have to be like, and I'd be like, no, I don't. No, because and part of me was what you guys were describing is I'd heard a lot of people being like, yeah, I got like triggered by watching that show, like the same way that like we all still have dreams about like ticket printers and like, you know.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Scene is in several of the episodes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
The ticket machine running over. Yeah.
Yeah, everyone like wakes up in a cold sweat if you've been in this industry long enough because you've heard that thing in your sleep. And I feel like people have told me that that's sort of the experience of watching the show, but it seems to me like they're kind of moving in a very almost doing what you guys were describing, where, you know, they sort of had to stamp their feet a little bit and say, we're here. And now they're kind of moving in a direction of like, okay, you know, we've been around, we've gotten some recognition, like let's flex our creative limbs a little bit and see what we can do. So I need to pick it up. But Damon, you were also saying that like, it kind of hit some special little nostalgia nerves for you, cause it reminded you a little bit of like your first spot in New York, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, just my early days, I was lucky enough to get into the industry right before the cocktail renaissance started. It was like the early 2000s. I mean, you know, we can say like Milk and Honey and Pagu Club and places like that were around, you know, already doing this kind of stuff. And like, but like really, when I got into it, it was, you know, I was in Oklahoma City. And so it was, that stuff was definitely not going to happen for years to come, you know, there with the cocktail kind of revival and renaissance. But I'd moved to New York City in the mid 2000s and I could feel it. And I felt it for, you know, almost a decade into, you know, basically to the time I opened Grand Army. But, I felt that change happening, but you know, it all started, you know, really for me, like getting into it and moved to New York City and, you know, doing what I wanted to do, with getting into this industry. Part of that is actually poignant for our guest today, because the first bar job, that I had in New York City, I was the head bartender at this little Japanese cocktail bar in Hell's Kitchen, that's long gone. And, you know, it was fun for me because not only like moving to New York City and being a bartender for a little bit, you know, like I couldn't get a job anywhere as a bartender. So I had to fall back on graphic design. And a lot of graphic designers got really pissed off at me in New York City because they were like, I can't find a graphic design job. There are too many graphic designers. So I guess I'm going to have to work in the service industry. And I was like, I can't get a job in the service industry because I didn't have New York experience, air quotes. But I was really thankful for that job because I got to meet some really amazing people. But realistically, it got me out of my comfort zone. I moved to New York because of the Manhattan cocktail. I knew I wanted to work in cocktails, and I knew I wanted to move to New York City, right? And this kind of got me out of my comfort zone, and I got to learn to speak Japanese a little bit, you know, which was also an interesting thing, talking about the bear and like language barriers and things like that that happened in the restaurant industry. So it was a very educational experience for me, and especially on the subject of the spirits that we were using. I mean, it was a lot of sake, but we were using shochu and soju in cocktails, and I got to learn all about them. And like, it's one of my favorite subjects. So I'm really, really excited to talk about this today, because we will be talking about the wonderful world of spirit that is soju. And there's no one better to have on the show to talk about this than our friend, Bran, who it's crazy looking at your bio. So we got to get into the show because there's a lot to talk about. But Bran Hill is the founder and master distiller of Toki Soju, and we're going to be talking about that today. So welcome to the show, Bran.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.
Absolutely. Where are you coming in from?
I'm in South Korea right now.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So you're like all over the place, though. I mean, like you've lived in Brooklyn and you're in South Carolina. I mean, like tell us about – I mean, first of all, like tell us what soju is for our listeners and kind of how you got into it.
Yeah, soju is the just national drink of Korea. It is inherently new, unique to Korea. And soju kind of found me. I wasn't looking for it. You know, I had a background brewing, distilling, and, a job kind of presented itself in Korea back in 2011, which was Year of the Rabbit. And that's kind of the auspicious symbol that made way to the namesake. Just kind of fell in love with it. And then from Korea, I moved to New York, like you said, was in Brooklyn, actually met you at Grand Army. And yeah. I didn't know it until I saw your face and you mentioned Grand Army. But I was a distiller at Van Brunt Stillhouse at the time.
Right.
When I came in there. Yeah. And then some of my friends from Korea and Sohee Kim and Yong from Insa, which is a restaurant in Gowanus. They were kind of doing elevated Korean food, and they wanted a elevated Korean soju, because at the time there was only green bottle soju available and they couldn't really pair it with their higher level food. So we talked for a while. I had access to a distillery. I knew how to make Korean soju, makgeolli, cheongju, many types of alcohol from Korea, and it just kind of snowballed, and here we are today, 8 years later, which is wild.
Awesome, man. Yeah, and Zoe's so awesome. Like, Insa's great. I mean, good for Gage and Tolner, all, you know, like amazing roster of restaurants, bars that they have, of course. So when you got into, like, I know for me, a lot of the way that I drink, it's cocktail forward. You know, that's the whole reason why I got into this industry. But, you know, the cool thing with soju is that, you know, traditionally it's drunk on its own, right? But it works really well in cocktails. And what's cool about your lineup too is that for me, a lot of my experience in the early days with soju and shochu is like, you know, it'd be like anywhere from like 24 to 35% alcohol. So it's actually like traditionally kind of like low ABV, but you're pushing it almost to like bottled in bond with some of your marks. I mean, it's up there. So it actually like really stands up and stands out in cocktails. So what's your kind of, what do you like to enjoy it? Like, I know a lot of times it's served on the rocks, you know, traditionally, or just like maybe with soda water as a highball. How do you like to enjoy it?
Yeah, I mean, you made a lot of good points there. It's soju is a totally different animal from the way it's consumed here in Asia to the West. It is, but oh, nice. Yeah, pop that bottle.
Let's get into it.
But yeah, I mean, that's kind of the thing. My partner Doug Park and I wanted to do is we wanted to make soju a global recognized spirit, and we knew that it really wasn't going to take off in the West unless it was able to be integrated in cocktails in the way you could drink in the West, which is more in kind of a bar format, where here in Asia, you know, it's definitely especially South Korea, it's called an anju culture, where you sit down and you drink with food. So you're always in a community. It's never really in a bar format. But actually, the traditional sojus, like way back from the Joseon dynasty, were high APV and high ABV. So like our black label, which is 40%, which is great for cocktails, or our gold label, which is 46, the barrel aged version. That's kind of the way they were drinking it back in the day. It was kind of whatever it came off the still at. It didn't really make the new format, which was the low ABV, until like the 1960s. And that's where kind of gave way to the green bottle sojus that we know today.
But that probably also spurred on the method of drinking, right? It's my understanding that you sort of crack open a bottle at the beginning of a meal and you have little tiny nips all throughout the meal until the bottle's gone. And effectively here, then food becomes the mixer, right? Plus, obviously, you know, the conversation at the table.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, it's very ritualistic too. So even the drinking culture, the way you pour for your friends, the way you cheers when you drink, it's very Confucianist. So the older you are, you take hierarchy in the format, where the younger drinkers have to turn and look away from their older counterparts. And yeah, it's a really cool drinking custom and culture surrounded by soju that we wanted to bring to the West and bring attention to the category, and kind of change the perception of it just being kind of the, you know, the bottom of the barrel green bottle stuff, which it has a beautiful history, and we want to have it operate on the same level of respect as like sakes and sochus.
Yeah, it, like, I just love that culture and that kind of run of show where it's like, as Souther said, the food becomes the mixer. But also, like, you know, I appreciate your work on this and bring it to the West, as you say. But guys, like, the whole world has drinking cultures like this. We're the ones who fucked up, you know, why don't we drink, you know, like, you know, bourbon's our national spirit. Why don't we have like nips of bourbon, you know, and toasts like with every bite, mm-hmm. you know, like, and you know, you think about like aquavit and vodka, like when you're sure. in those zones and like how they drink it, like spirits are so like, they need to be normalized again in the United States as something that you do have in a social setting, like a dinner, you know, like we kind of romanticize wine, but it's like, you know, brandy also works. It's distilled wines. I just say it, you know, it's like, there's a lot of work to be done in just the way that we drink alcohol in the United States. I think it's really cool to bring, like when we do bring in something like a soju or an aquavit, you know, when you go to Sammy's Romanian, or, you know, there's always like a bottle of vodka on the table, and you're just, it's like kind of showing America that the rest of the world had, like, this is totally normal, you know, and
that there are traditions and, you know, rituals right. that involve not just, it's not just something to,
you know, way older than us, by the way.
Yeah. It's not just something to get your load on and get the job done. I want to talk a little bit about your soju and soju in general. Like, there's so many, other spirit categories that are, so closely named and so closely associated that I think there's a lot of confusion going on. So can you talk a little bit about, like, what is soju made of? How is it made, and what sets it apart from, say, some of the other spirits from that region?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, and part of bringing soju,
as I sit here and just enjoy this while I listen.
No, yeah, please have at it. Yeah, it was a big conversation, especially when we started the company in Brooklyn. It took a lot of education, and, you know, because some people would see it and they're like, oh, I don't get it. Is it sake? Is it like a Korean vodka? So soju is derived from the Chinese so and ju, so meaning burnt, ju meaning alcohol. Same with sochu. It's just the Japanese have a little bit different pronunciation, but it's still based on the kanji or the hanja of Chinese. The main difference is distillation was brought into Korea by the Mongolians, and they had ceramic lambic style stills. And soju was usually made from rice, and their yeast and enzyme was called Nuruk, which is N-U-R-U-K. It's the same enzyme as koji, which is Aspergillus oryzae, but in Japan, it's cultivated off of rice. In Korea, it's cultivated off wheat or barley cakes, which usually has some wild yeast attached to it. And baijiu, which is kind of which is the Chinese version. Bai is the Chinese for white, which means white liquor, is now more popular with sorghum and usually the highest ABV of all three. So China, I usually equate to sorghum. Korea, nuruk and rice was the original way until like the 1960s. Korea did a ban on using rice for alcohol just so they could use the rice to feed the nation. And that was lifted in 1999, but never really made a resurgence back to the old ways until now. Like now there's kind of a renaissance in new sojus. And sochu in Japan, usually made from sweet potato or barley, koji being the enzyme. And there's, I believe, three islands in the south that have the designation that they can do sochu out of black sugar cane. But yeah, they taste way different. I'm sure your Japanese is better than mine. I'm not sure.
Black sugar, Well, there's also I've seen sesame shochus and all kinds of cool, maybe not like traditional, but just kind of like offshoots and like kind of the same way that we like flavor different spirits, but it's naturally flavored, you know? And they're just like, I love the sweet potato stuff too. It's so good. And it's a little bit more like earthy and raw. It kind of reminds me of like the mezcal of the East, you know, of sorts. Like I said, I love this subject, so don't let me bother or interrupt. Keep going.
No, not at all. Yeah, jump in at any time.
I'll start drinking now.
the fermentation processes are a lot different, especially when you start drifting away from cereal grains and you start using things like sweet potato or sugars. And then distillation's a lot different from Japan to Korea as well. But yeah, they because they sound the same, they're usually interchangeable in conversations. But yes, sochu, soju, wildly different. Soju, Korea; sochu, Japan. Yeah,
I like how to me, going back to the food conversation after you just tasted yours, the thing that makes this work so well for me too is it's just so clean, you know. And so it's. I remember my first experiences with it, with both soju and shochu. I was just like, wait, and this is like, maybe it's a PSA, but I've never had a hangover when I drink this stuff, you know, and I've had a lot of it in certain settings, but it's just, to me, it's just like a clean, very natural feeling alcohol. And sorry, go ahead, Greg.
Well, I was just wondering, and I want to say just a bit of counter evidence. I have had a hangover just from drinking this because you, Bran, sent me and all of us actually very generously a lot of samples, and I sampled pretty hard one night, and I was feeling the results of all of that hard work that I did for my job the next morning. Boy. But I do sort of wonder with spirits like this that have that kind of malleable base ingredient. I think we sort of get, I don't know, maybe I get held up on categorizations more than other people do. But I guess I sort of want to know, what is the through line for you in terms of soju, in that it can be all these different ABVs and made with all of these different raw ingredients, and it's not like, you know, brandy, which has to be made from fruit, or rum, which has to be made from some sort of sugar product. What to you is kind of like what makes soju soju? What's sort of the through line and the heart of it for you?
No, that's a great question. And you know, there is no real AOC or designation on what soju is, and that's mostly because of the Korean government. You know, they the green bottles are mostly just kind of ethanol with whatever they source from that year, you know, where it can be like tapioca, wheat, overstock from Brazil, like cane. And then that just their kind of chemical cocktail. But what we wanted to do is showcase a traditional recipe. So I'm doing a traditional recipe called a bumbuck style. And this is from the Joseon dynasty. And that's kind of like the only way I know how to tell my story. Is what we're doing is we're taking ancient recipes and bringing them to the modern world with, you know, new technology, like better distillation techniques and fermentation techniques, and have refrigeration. And yeah, like you said, David, like it is so clean. And The white label, which you're drinking now, is supposed to not compete with Korean food, like, because Korean food is so, you know, spicy, sour, flavorful, that it's supposed to almost be like a palate cleanser, you know, nothing that kind of interrupts the meal. And that's why it's, it's just supposed to be really clean. We're really strict with our cuts, you know, because we're not adding anything on the back end. There's no sugars, no chemicals, no additives. So, yeah, it's super clean. It's the heart of the run. And that's why hopefully you don't get as many hangovers as Greg, maybe. But yeah, the white label is supposed to be clean, supposed to be really easy to drink, sip with a meal, because like Sather was saying, it's, you know, just kind of nibs and shots throughout the meal.
Well, you also can call that hangover user error brand. It's fine. It's not. Don't worry.
Also, when it comes to food, it's like even the higher proof stuff that you sent to us, it's like the thing that I've always gotten out of like soju and soju, like with food, is like, you know, we kind of think of like spirits as hot here in the States, because a lot of times they are, you know, but, you know, and we don't really drink too many types of spirits here neat, especially when it comes to food, but there's something really cool and refreshing, even with the higher proof stuff, that's like extinguishing for those spicy foods. They just go really well together. It's like kind of what grows together, goes together, that whole saying, you know, and it works incredibly well together. More soju, please. Like it's
yeah.
I'm glad you sent 5 bottles to me so I can continue to enjoy it. But they're going to, I mean, like, you know, Greg is much younger than me, and he drinks a lot heavier than I do these days. So maybe that's the problem. Maybe it's just I'm old, and I've slowed down in my age.
You've tempered yourself a little bit.
But you were saying, like, kind of speaking of food, I mean, was there working with Zoe, like, you know, kind of talking about some of the food and traditional thing, like in like working with Van Brunt Stillhouse, like, was this like kind of a combination of influences and neighbors and like your community, to kind of figure out like how you wanted to approach this? I mean, was there a inspiration that comes from that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I worked with Yong and Sohee from Insa on developing their soju, which was kind of the first. It was a different recipe and a different soju than what Toki was. So, you know, it was just kind of them coming to me and they were like, hey, we want kind of a house soju. Is this something you're interested in? I'm like, absolutely. Like, let's do it. Let's get weird.
What was that development process like? I mean, was it just a lot of eating and drinking? Like, just tasting?
I mean, yeah, it was mostly just, you know, a couple of, like a lot of small batches, pairing it. And then, you know, they kind of wanted a sweeter version, you know, to kind of bridge the gap from what people knew as soju in the US with the green bottle stuff to, you know, to a more elevated version. And yeah, they were just so amazing. And it went over so well that more and more Korean restaurants just kept lighting up my inbox to the point where I had to start taking it seriously. I took on a Korean American partner, Doug, and he convinced me that, yeah, it was bigger than me. Like, let's have soju have a moment. And I was like, yeah, as long as, you know, Koreans and Korean restaurants are down with me doing it, let's go. So yeah, it's been a wild ride. It's been 8 years, first 4 in Brooklyn, the second 4 we've been in Korea, which I'm at right now, and yeah, hopefully another 8 to come or more.
So yeah, you started in Brooklyn, that... you're now producing, you're producing in Korea, or you're producing here in America?
So we're in what I like to say 3.0 of Toki. The first iteration was just Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And we kind of just hoarded our money, saved it to build a distillery out here in Korea. We thought if we really wanted to change the category, we should start at the motherland using, you know, the local ingredients and everything. So the second 4 years, we built the distillery here. And we just now are in our third tier where we're expanding. And we're now distilling out of California and Korea, just because California actually grows more Korean chop salad, their rice varietal, than Korea. So we were going to, you know, eventually hit kind of a plateau on how much we could produce. So we're now distilling out of California as well.
Well, plus I'm certain that helps with your footprint, right? Like if you're producing and selling in Korea and you're producing and selling in America, then that's reducing, you know, a lot of like carbon emissions, et cetera, right?
That's the point, yeah. And so, yeah, logistically, it makes a lot more sense, yeah, just to do it there too. And yeah, hopefully North America.
What about this? I mean, like, you know, it's interesting that you were able to start producing and continue producing in the United States and calling it soju with so many spirit categories that have, you know, over just in this century, you know, have gotten their AOC, their appellations recognized by the TTB. You know, we were talking with our friend Steven Soderbergh. Steven Soderbergh. you got a new name. About Cinquani last week, and you know, he got the TTB to recognize Cinquani as an Appalachian spirit, right? Is there any plan? You said it's kind of like, it's kind of wild there, right? You can kind of make it in a lot of different ways. There's no real rules. I was wondering if that's something you're considering kind of spearheading to make it an actual Appalachian, or probably not though, because then that means you probably have to exclusively distill in South Korea, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would have no issue with that, to be honest. Like, I would really love that for Korea. I know that will never happen just because the soju, so all the green bottle sojus are not distilleries. They're not producers. They just buy bulk spirit from the government, and the government does not get it from Korea. So there's no way that they're going to do that because that's their cash cow. So, you know, it's a $3 billion business that they're kind of, you know, tapping at both sides, where they're not only selling the booze to the bottlers, which are the green bottle soju brands, but then they're also taxing it on the sale of that. So I can't ever see them putting a hard designation on soju. I would have no problem with it. I would forego for Korea, but.
So is it similar? Sorry, we're asking so many like nerdy business questions.
Let's get into it.
Kind of what the show is, you know.
Yeah.
But when you say green bottle soju, so you know, it sounds to me like not dissimilar to some of the larger, say, whiskey producers in the United States, where a lot of people like create their own brands and labels, but they're buying the juice from distilleries. But you're saying the government actually distills and brings in product from outside of the country. Are there any like quote unquote green bottle sojus that are like the hip brand kind of thing, like with flashy packaging, you know, that are like kind of like faking the funk, like some of the, I won't name any names, you know, like certain like bourbons, you know, that are like, oh yeah. I mean, I would say like, I give the examples like, you know, oh yeah, George Washington totally, like, this was his distillery. It's like fucking bullshit. I had nothing to do with this. You're just using that. Is there any kind of that happening in South Korea with soju?
Not as much. They're not really trying to be like the cool craft scene. They're kind of trying to be the budget soju, you know, right. Like it, gotcha. It's kind of, you know, it sells for, you know, one of the 350 milliliter bottles goes for the equivalent of a dollar. So they're really not trying to too hard. Volume is their game. They're definitely not trying to look cool.
That's probably what Greg was actually drinking when he got that hangover, right?
We can't rule it out at this point.
Yeah. No worries. I mean, I think there's a place for all sojus, you know, including theirs. I just, you know, we wanted to show a tier. We wanted to show that it can be elevated to another level, and that, you know, it has a cool history that really isn't told outside of Korea. And even in Korea, very small minutia.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills combined with the freshest milk available created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
The world is changing faster than ever, and you need a website to go with it. Whether you're a seasoned pro looking to build your following or just starting out with a brand new idea, you need a landing page that's bold, innovative, and uniquely yours.
Whatever your passion, you need a web designer with experience, panache, and heart. We can't help you with any of that. Hi, I'm Lou Bank.
And I'm Greg Benson. Are we Silicon Valley tech visionaries? No, we're podcast hosts, and that's basically the same thing. And we're here to tell you about Ancestral Agave Syrup.
Ancestral Agave Syrup is the 100% pure nectar of the agave plant. Now, wait a minute, you're thinking. I've had 100% pure agave nectar. Well, not like this, you haven't.
That stuff is processed with a diffuser, which introduces acid. Plus, it comes from Blue Weber, a monoculture that dominates farms, depletes the soil, and won't help you grow your brand or expand your e-commerce functionality.
Ancestral agave syrup, on the other hand, is made by slowly cooking down the pure agua miel from Salmiana agaves in Hidalgo and Tlaxcala, two states that have been harvesting those plants for generations. It also won't expand your e-commerce functionality, but it will grow your brand if your brand is person who makes kick-ass margaritas or pecan pies or pancakes.
Unfortunately, the families behind this tasty stuff are being offered big beer company bucks to rip out their agave and plant barley instead, which would be a crime because Ancestral Agave Syrup is about as far from the processed stuff as 100% pure Vermont maple syrup is from that sticky bottle at a diner.
So, don't build a homepage from one of several easy-to-use templates, but do grab Ancestral Agave Syrup today. Our first 25 customers will also receive a special limited edition agave superhero comic book. So do not wait. Protect the land, make better drinks, and save the bats by grabbing some today.
Wait, what was that about bats?
Yeah, it's an important food source on the migration path of the Mexican long-nosed bat.
Huh.
Yeah, the flowering stalks of the agave also provide protection from predators.
Oh, well, that's cool. Should we get back to the ad now?
Yeah, let's do that. Go to ancestralagave.com or click the link in the show notes to grab some today.
Ancestral Agave Syrup. It won't help you build a beautiful website, but it will make your cocktails taste really, really good.
I want to talk a little bit about how you're sort of a triple threat on the bottle that's in front of us. You have a major in both molecular biology as well as business, plus you have some art background. So you made the thing, you made the business of the thing, and then you created the label on the thing.
Yeah, I mean, it was a one-man show at the beginning. I have art background, science background, business background, but I don't know, I can't take all the credit. I did bounce some ideas off other friends and had my friend Elizabeth help me with the label as well. But yeah, I drew it to where I wanted it to feel like an East meets West, kind of like what Toki is, where I really love American woodblock prints, which is kind of the main, if you're looking at the bottle, I think the listeners probably won't be able to see it. But then with an Asian black and white motif and with the Korean red stamp. And yeah, just kind of, you know, like what Doug and I are, we're, you know, East meets West. I guess more so him than I.
Well, I mean, it's a beautiful bottle. And from what I hear, it's kind of, you mentioned that since you moved back to Korea, the moving into phase 3.0 has been challenging for a good reason, because demand in Korea has outstripped the supply. Like, you, it sounds like the original idea was, you know, go to Korea, make it there, and then ship some of it back to the United States. But it sounds like there's so much demand for it locally that you're having to sort of pivot that. So I guess I wanted to know what that feels like to you, you know, because I know that you came in with this mission to start using a lot of traditions and ingredients and methods that had been, you know, forgotten or set aside. What is that validating? Is it like a little frustrating to be like, oh shoot, it's working too well, and now I have to readjust my plans? Sort of, how has that been for you?
Definitely not working too well. I would love that problem. That sounds amazing. That sounds amazing. I like expanding and growing a business is, you know, kind of hard in its own. It's just creating the infrastructure is its own thing. And, you know, we are a startup. Luckily, I have my business partner, Doug, who's much more, I mean, despite what you mentioned, me having a business degree, he's more of the prodigy for growth and strategy than I am. You know, if I had it my way, I would just kind of be, you know, listening to music in the distillery, just filling barrels. But no, it's great. You know, I love that people are starting to check out new spirits, and especially looking to the East. You know, I think that's kind of the next bridge in cocktail spirits. You mentioned, I actually learned something from your guys' podcast. My first cocktail experience was also in New York in Chinatown. And I was saying this bar wrong the whole time until I listened to your podcast. I also thought it was Apotheke and not Apo. Was it Apotheke? Is that how they pronounce it?
Apotheke.
Apotheke, yeah. Yeah. I was saying Apotheke the whole time with my friends. That was my first introduction to cocktail bars in general. I just moved from Korea to New York when I was 29. I'm 40 now. And that was my first introduction. I was like, this is super cool. And in the scene in Chinatown. And and I was just like, you know what? That was actually a huge inspiration that was in Chinatown. I was like, let's do Asian spirits. So I was doing it for fun. And that's how Sohee found out about it, through her friends.
Well, I mean, to be fair, when they came on the show, they did say that they deliberately made it so that you don't know how to pronounce the name. So I don't think either we're all right or none of us are. I think that's the way to go.
Yeah, I think that's the way they want it. Creates a little bit of tension. You mentioned a second ago you'd be happy enough just hanging out in the distillery, putting product into barrel. And then that made me actually want to question, is barreling this product a common thing, or is this an innovation that your brand is producing?
Yeah, this is kind of something that, you know, my background is in whiskey and, you know, Western spirits. And, you know, rice is a cereal grain, just like corn, wheat, barley, rye. And there's so many parallels to American whiskey and soju fermentation. You know, it's a grain on fermentation. Corn and rice convert at very similar temperatures. They're very sweet. And the way that we distill and ferment, I was like, this is begging to be put in a barrel. And it hits all of the check marks of a whiskey and a barrel aged soju. So it's technically, you know, the first sticky rice whiskey and a barrel aged soju. You know, when you taste it, you know, you're not drinking a bourbon, but you know, there's some familiarity. And especially for Western drinkers, I thought this was a great way to kind of bridge the gap and start the conversation. It's like, oh, this feels familiar. And then go maybe, you know, a little deeper down the rabbit hole, no pun intended, and trying like the other SKUs. And it is not common, especially, you know, there's no oak out here. There's no real barreling culture. This is totally, you know, Doug and I's love for whiskey personified with soju.
And how's it been being received or looked at?
It's great. So like behind soju, Korea's next most popular spirit, or most by volume drink spirit, is whiskey. And you know, like Japan, big highball culture, so really well received, really good in cocktails, and we're expanding that as well into the gold label. Togi Soju Gold Label is our first. That was virgin American oak, and we liked it so much we want to kind of continue that barrel program. Our next one is called the Garnet, which we're releasing this month, which is our sherry cast. Koreans love Speyside scotches. Anything sherry cast is usually a go for them. So that was easily my next choice. We barrel aged in PX Pedro Jimenez cast. And and then some new weird stuff coming on the way. This is the year of the rabbit that we're in now, at least for the next couple weeks before the dragon starts. And for this year, I did a smoked rice soju that we barrel aged called Toki Jade Label. I might revisit that again. I really love that one too. It was amazing in a old fashioned.
Are there any other soju brands out there that are trying these sort of barreling innovations, or is it you think kind of maybe, as you've referred to numerous times, the green bottle guys? They just want to get volume, they just want to get it out, so they don't have any intention in their mind to like hold stuff and age it any. They want to get it on shelves and get it sold for a dollar a bottle.
Yeah, there's Huayo has now started a barrel age program, but I mean it's not common. It's kind of a newer thing. Western.
That's great. You're out there innovating and bringing something new to the market that's unique, but has ties to your history, to history of how things are done in other places in the world. I think that's pretty awesome.
Thanks so much. Thanks. Yeah, we're proud of
it. I can't wait to crack that bottle open. But I'm really enjoying this bottle.
Yeah, I was going to say, like
this is
even with the highball. I mean, I have a sparkling water right here, and I was like, I'm just going to make this a little light highball while I've got some in my glass. But you know, my wife and I drink highballs all the time at home, and that was when I saw the two barrel aged bottles. We're like, well, we're going to make a highball with this,
and yeah, totally, absolutely,
it kicks ass, you know. I wanted to ask, because there's this thing that happens, I've realized, in all my work and education with spirits. Like, so many people don't understand the middle part of the process, which is the fermentation part. So we know that this is made from grain, right? We know that whiskey is made from grain. Bourbon's made from corn. You know, brandy's made from fruit, you know. But people forget about the middle process, like, you know, the grapes become wine, the grain becomes beer. Can you talk to us about the fermented product before distillation?
Absolutely, yeah. And that's also, you know, kind of what the wort is, or what the fermentation is. It also creates two other types of alcohol that they drink in Korea. One is called Cheongju, which is also the name of the city that I'm currently in, and Makgeolli, which is the other one. So it is, like I was saying, it's a grain-on fermentation. So the style we do is called a bumbuck fermentation. So we mill the rice, similar to an American whiskey. The other style is called gorubap, which is steamed rice. I do the milled rice just because you have access to more fermentable sugars, gets a sweeter distillate. But what happens is, in the fermentation, it'll stack where the rice sediment will go to the bottom. And then the top layer has the higher alcohols. Alcohol is lighter than water, which goes to the top. And that kind of what a lot of people consider rice wine, that's called the Cheongju layer. They'll rack that off and drink that. And it's kind of like a clear yellowish kind of a, usually around, it depends how much you feed the culture, but usually around like 10% alcohol, sometimes higher. And that lower part is called Makgeolli, which is kind of like a Nagore sake, like kind of like a silty, milky. So Makgeolli, it was known as like the people's drink. That's what everybody drank. And it's kind of like a rice beer. You know, in Korea, sometimes they even add like Sprite or soju, right, as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that top layer is more fancy and usually, you know, kind of sipped like a wine would. But that's our base fermentation. And when they're together, it's called Wanju, like it's one culture. And then we distill on the grain as well. We don't run it through a centrifuge or do a wash run or anything like that, which is the way they did it. So yeah, that the fermentation, also good stuff. I make that as well, just to drink for fun. It's really good. Makgeolli and Cheongju.
Yeah.
Well, that kind
I've
of
had both. And I think that's like one of those things that, like, I'm glad you explained that, because like, I think for a lot of times our listeners might not understand that middle part of the process, or the beginning part of the process. And it's like, it's fascinating to me that there's a whole culture around that, you know, before you get to the distillate. And that's, you know, when we think about just the basics, the need for creating these products, it was all based on preservation, right? Preservation of the grain. And then you make it into the Makgeolli, right? But then you're like, oh, well, that's going to turn. So we got to figure out how to preserve that now. So then it's distillation. And it, you know, it's like, it's just all like, it's all based on, you know, the growth of the raw product, and then how we save it, you know, and then also how we can have fun along the way with every step of the process.
No, yeah, absolutely. Really cool. Yeah, and Greg, yeah. Go ahead, Greg.
Sorry.
Oh no, I mean, I was just you know what, Brand? You go ahead and respond to that, because I got this might. You just go ahead and do that.
Okay. Yeah, I was just gonna say. Yeah, you're so right. I mean, Korea is just like the OG of fermentation, from like food to alcohol, and like, right, every stage of the process whether they're, you know, fermenting their foods or fermenting their grains to drink or to eat. It's like you said, it's all about preservation. You know, when they didn't know when the next harvest was going to come. So, you know, they were burying their clay pots, also preserving their alcohol in ongi, which are those jars that you see that kimchi's preserved in as well. So, yeah, they've been doing it, you know, long before the U.S. was a country. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it is cool to see and to dive into that for sure.
Yeah, totally. What about, okay, so like let's take a little bit further. I mean, we've talked about the barrel aging, which is an innovation that you've kind of spearheaded and taken like just you're taking the flag and running with it. But you have created in your lineup, I was really shocked because as I mentioned before, I was tasting through all the sample bottles and then I got to Sumby and it's a gin and it's very, 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 my career has been a lot in, you know, helped create several different gins over time. And I just love gin. And I want to hear about this one and kind of what the inspiration was with it. Is gin like a thing in South Korea? I mean, are there any botanicals that go into this gin that are specific to the area? Can you tell us more about that one?
Yeah, absolutely. I love these questions. I feel like you're teeing me up for all the points that I wanted to hit. So, yeah, Sunbi is our other spirits.
We're
line.
Just nerds,
so
we do, man.
No,
yeah, I'm just huge nerds.
I'll get as weird as you want. Sunbi is, so Toki, we do all of our Korean spirits under the name Toki. All of our Western spirits with Korean ingredients, we do under the name Sunbi. Sunbi in Korean is kind of the word for a person that's a scholar. They give up their kind of worldly status in society to just kind of learn more and enlighten themselves. And that's kind of like our ethos with the brand. We don't want to kind of rest on our laurels. We kind of want to always be innovating, doing new weird stuff. And Korea just has so many cool root vegetables, fruits that are just perfect for gin. In Korean, they call it yakju, which like literally translates to like medicine liquor, where they're making like what I would consider a gin or just kind of like a, kind of like a clarified Amaro or Amari. And I just wanted to showcase, I wanted to showcase a lot of these. And I was like, this will make, so the gin that I sent you guys, Sunbi Gin, is technically a London dry style, but with Korean botanicals, two of which are only found in that gin, one of which is called Omija, which is a Korean berry that only grows in Korea and Manchuria. And Omija means five flavored berry. And I think if more distillers knew about this, it'd be integrated in so many more mash bills because it's kind of like a catch-all for gin distillers. Like it hits that like peppery corn note that you want. It gets you that nice, like kind of dry flavor. It gives you that spice. It gives you that fruity element from the berry and has like almost like a salty taste too, which is, it just really rounds out the gin. And kamcho, which is like a licorice bark that also just gives it that nice drying agent on the back end that you want for a nice London dry gin. But yes, Sunbi in Korea, we don't have this in the US yet, but we made Korea's first vodka as well, which Sunbi vodka is the same rice we make our soju from, just distilled to be a vodka as well.
Wow.
That's wild. And yeah. I mean, I've got the gin is the only bottle that I didn't sample in my, again, you know, very serious work research.
Your in-depth look at the Toki
that I
brand.
Went on. Yeah. So I'm super excited to try that out now. If our guests wanted to follow along and see what you're up to. Also, before we do that, is there anything coming up that you want to tease? Any thing that you're working on that you want to maybe say that people should keep their eyes out for?
Yeah, keep an eye out for that barrel age program we've been talking about. So the Toki Soju Garnet label is the next one to kind of hit the American market. And that's the Sherry Cask one, which, higher ABV, 46%. So really good for building a cocktail. If you're into whiskey, this is a great gateway drug. Like it's good for the whiskey enthusiast. Yeah, it's super fun. You know, it is a soju, but, you know, it's reminiscent of a whiskey. That one's coming out. And then, yeah, for Sunbee, we want to keep doing more stuff with that. You know, as the brand grows, we want to do more Western spirits and showcase cool Korean ingredients. So look out for that too.
Well, I'm stoked for it. And if our guests wanted to follow along and keep up with your exploits, where's the best place for them to do that?
I think our Instagram, whenever we kind of unlock a new territory that we're selling in or releasing a new SKU or any kind of fun event that we're doing, Instagram's good, which is just at Toki Soju. Yeah, we're pretty good about it. And one more thing we have in the pipeline, not available in America, but anyone in Korea right now, we have another soju coming out called Hechi, which is a little bit different fermentation distillation style. And yeah, check that one out as well. You can find that on Toki Soju's links too.
Incredible. Nice. This man, this has been so much fun. And it's yeah. You know, I know that there's a lot more to talk about. And we love having people like you on the show who have like a wealth of knowledge about this stuff. And like, there, I know we could just talk forever, but I know we're at time today, but man, we would love to have you back on the show to dig in deeper, you know, and like maybe go over some of the other expressions, like some of the barrel aged ones that we talked about, but maybe we do an on-air tasting with them as well, you know? And I think it's cool that you built this, man. I remember meeting you in Brooklyn and I love that you've expanded this and you built that. And, you know, me coming from a graphic design background, I really love the label too. And the thing is, it's a new year and you said it was year of rabbit, but there's also this, this tradition saying rabbit every, like the first thing you say at the beginning of the day. So I like that, but I also love the woodblock carving style, but the label's really clean too. And it really reflects like what the juice is inside.
Yeah, exactly. You it's know a what I mean? Of what's it's, in the glass. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So very cool stuff, man. And, I'm glad you made the time to get on the horn with us from South Korea. It's cool really that we do this show this way these days, because you know, being in the studio, we definitely miss being in the studio in Brooklyn, at Heritage Radio Network, but this really opens us up. And, you know, it started with COVID doing the remote shows, but you know, being able to talk to anyone at any time from around the world, so long as you're awake, it's just great. So we really appreciate you taking the time to be here today and talking with us about it. So everyone go check out Toki Soju. It's fantastic stuff. And to me, it's like history and culture in a bottle, you know, when you're drinking spirits like this. So how do you say cheers in Korean?
So the more common way is to just say chan, which means glass, but or you can say ganbei.
I like chan.
just chan.
Glass. Yeah. Okay, yeah, so that's exactly. It for the speakeasy this week. Check out Heritage Radio Network for more programs like this one. Click on the beating heart to donate to the station. Keep us going. And until next week, chan.
Chan, everybody.
Chan.
So you don't chan the devil with your rock.
The speakeasy is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food and drink radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.